There's a city on the French Riviera of about 170-odd thousand people. At any other time of year, it'd be a fairly quiet, sleepy spot. But of course, the prestigious Cannes Film Festival changes everything. And behind the buzz of film lovers swarming its shores, there's a busy force of print devotees catering to the daily appetites of the industry's elite. We'll review the press in Cannes, today on The Stack. On today's programme, from Variety to The Hollywood Reporter, we'll take a closer look at the daily print the festival wakes up to during the annual jamboree. Also ahead,
the room in which these magazines have been able to sort of step back and sort of dig a little into just the sort of impact, really, of basically losing big parts of an entire town.
We'll cross to our Toronto and Hong Kong bureau for an international take on what's making the printed page. All that ahead on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. We'll cross to Toronto in a moment. First, though, the Cannes Film Festival is, of course, the pinnacle of international cinema events. But staying informed when you're buzzing from theatre to press conference and then back again takes more than a little eavesdropping on the red carpet. Variety and The Hollywood Reporter are among the print titles that produce a dedicated daily edition for the festival, ensuring that attendees are always in the know. Monocle's Ben Ryland's the presenter of the cinema show here on Monocle 24, and he's recently touched down after spending a few days in Cannes. Good to have you back with us in London, Ben. Let's sort of jump into the way that the media adapts to Cannes. I mentioned these daily editions. We know it's a kind of an industry event as much as it's a critical event. Is there a real sense of, you know, what are the stories that are going to be on the front pages? Is it the thing that everyone wants to look at first thing in the morning?
Absolutely. And this is actually something that I think a lot of people would be surprised about in Cannes, is that it kind of reignites this appetite for the daily printed press. I mean, you do walk around the festival every day and find people who are carrying a copy of The Hollywood Reporter or Variety under their arms. I was actually waiting in line, and I know you mentioned that in your introduction just there, but one of the best ways you can know what people are talking about is to simply stand in line and eavesdrop on what everyone else is saying.
I mean, there are some ethical considerations there, Ben, but we're not going to get bogged down by that.
I don't know what you're referring to at all. But I did pick up on a couple of people who would reference something they read in Variety, and I remember one man, he was talking about how he spends half of his life in Pittsburgh and then half of his life in London, and then he was in Cannes and he was about to fly off to Bologna as well to go to the film festival over there. So he's clearly the jet-setting type, and he said that the way that he remains informed about everything that's happening in Cannes is that he picks up a copy of Variety every day, and he'll sit down and read it from cover to cover, and he'll know exactly what's on the agenda, and then he can go about gathering his own information and sourcing that back to whatever editorial body that he was reporting back to.
And what's interesting is I think we often talk about the authority of print, good print, well-made journalism, and that example is a case in point. People still, I don't know, trust the printed page more. There's something qualitatively different, it seems, about reading a daily publication from cover to cover. I'm sure some of that information will be floating around in various chat rooms and forums, but it just doesn't have the same, I don't know, authority.
Well, I think that is definitely true, yes. I mean, there is something to be said about the design and authority that the two publications I have in front of me here, Variety and The Hollywood Reporter. Both of these have long histories in, particularly in Hollywood, obviously, being American publications. But, I mean, there is something about having the news in front of you in its printed form. But also, I think it needs to be said that really, it's much more user-friendly to have these on a piece of paper that you can carry around with you. Walking around Cannes with your electronic devices, which of course you're going to need to record and report back to whoever it is you're working for, that is an effort in itself. You really don't want to be having to rely on some sort of Wi-Fi connection, internet connection, when you're down in the basement at the Marché du Film.
You might trip over aforementioned red carpet if you're not watching where you're going.
I mean, you could. It wouldn't be the first time, would it?
Now, one of the things that strikes me, Ben, with the titles that you've got here, and you've got, I'm looking at day five, this is the Sunday edition of Variety, I think you've got a day seven and a selection of others there, and The Hollywood Reporter too. These are serious magazines, you know,
Absolutely.
Large format, glossy, high production value, the kind of thing we're used to seeing at best in weekly publications, and it's an amazing
Exactly.
thing to churn out, well, this many words, and looking as good as this on a daily basis.
I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, there is so much reliance on these publications. And on top of the daily edition, Variety also, of course, still produce their weekly edition too, which they just relaunched in time for the festival. So there is this this thicker version of Variety that we've got here. Has a beautiful cover. It's an advertising tie-in here with Chopin. It's actually a beautifully textured cover too. So they've got the tie-in cover that wraps around, and then inside that you've got the main cover here, which is for the opening of the Cannes Film Festival. Tom, there's also a column in here from the editor of Variety that just explains a little bit of background behind why they decided to relaunch the look and feel of the publication. And I mean, look, Variety is a bit of an exception amongst these publications. If you open a copy of The Hollywood Reporter, well, sometimes it does verge into just a bit of a show business magazine. Variety is a very, very different story there. You can open that up and you can
read. It's got lots of graphs in it, Ben. So
exactly.
It's for the serious business savvy people out there.
Serious at a glance, just add graph.
Now, they're beautiful things. And what's interesting is it's all bound up together. You get an event like Cannes, which, okay, it's a big business jamboree, but it is also about old school glamour. And you get these magazines that, I don't know, tap back into that age of the glamour of magazines, and the two things, you know, they feed one another, and it just, I don't know, it makes me feel like I want to go to Cannes and I want to read these titles every day. There's a sort of a pleasing retro charm almost to it. Did you get that feeling on the ground as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, something that speaks to that perfectly is so the Cannes Film Festival actually offers an app which you can download to an Android or an iPhone, and it's very, very user friendly. It's absolutely fantastic. It will send you alerts about what is screening in the Grand Theatre Lumiere every day. Will tell you when something big has happened, some new film has been announced or something like that. Great for notifications like that. The number of people that I actually saw walking around using that as their actual organizer, very, very few. There is a daily screening bulletin that gets produced as it almost looks like a bit of a map. So it's a large rectangular pamphlet which you can open up, and it's like a bit of a roadmap to what is screening where. 90% of the people that you see walking around the festival are actually using the ye old map.
It's a triumph of print. That's what we're talking about, Cannes, in the print capacity.
Exactly.
Now, I should ask you, Ben, about, you got another, well, this is an impressive looking, very elegant publication that you have there. What's that?
I didn't want to leave the stack today without just mentioning briefly the beautifully crafted print edition of the official programme for the 69th Cannes Film Festival. This is it in front of me here. It is fairly hefty indeed.
Ben's, for our listeners' sake, Ben's almost struggling to lift it.
I was just struck at how beautiful this book is, and it is a book. It doesn't even feel like a magazine, really. I mean,
it's kind of like one of those very high-end sort of art catalogue of, you know, artists' works, and lovely sort of retro lettering.
Just the way that this programme is filled out, the design inside, the typography, everything just comes together so perfectly, which really just speaks to how prestigious and how serious this film event is.
Indeed. Ben, thanks so much for being with us on The Stack. And of course, if you're intrigued to hear more from Ben and his reports from Cannes, you can delve into the archive of The Cinema Show. We had a couple, I think, well, certainly one special edition, and other stuff throughout our schedule. Ben, thanks for being with us on the programme. Now, of course, many of the journalists on site in Cannes, alongside Ben, are there to report news back to their international editors. So just how do you report news to those who are in the business of doing exactly that? Well, we put the question to one of those Variety journalists who's been hard at work at Cannes, Leo Barraclough.
We do 7 dailies in Cannes, and I mean, there's a mixture of articles we go for. Firstly, there's the press conferences for the competition films in Cannes, and usually we'll get a few quotes from the stars and put that into a story. Then there's the parties in the evenings, again focused on the stars that attend, not necessarily in films, but they could be fashion models or singers, anyone famous who we'll be interested in. And then there's the new projects that haven't been made yet but are being launched in order to get financing, and we'll hear about those from either the producers or from the sales companies that are selling them. Then there's the films that have been produced or are being produced, and the sales agents will be selling them around the world in territory by territory, which is how independent films finance themselves. and we'll report on the deals. Then there may be casting stories, so we'd get those stories from the agents of the stars or from the producers or the sales agents. And then there's a whole bunch of other stories. I mean, for example, the European Union are bringing in new rules on how copyright is operated, and that's of interest to the industry, and so it goes on.
Describe to me how you and your colleagues go about making sure that you've canvassed every possible angle to make sure that you are really covering everything that is at the festival. Because really, looking through a copy of Variety when you're at Cannes, it does feel as though you're on top of every angle.
We've got a team of 8 reporters. I mean, I must admit that doesn't ensure that we cover everything, because a lot of stories are exclusive, so people pick and choose who they go with. Some of them share it out, some of it we discover ourselves. But throughout the year, we're in touch with the producers and with the sales agents, the casting agents, etc. And so Cannes is the kind of pinnacle of the year. It's our equivalent to Wimbledon, you know. I mean, that's when everyone focuses their attention and they want to be seen. So Variety is the or one of the top places to be seen in. So there's a whole army of publicists whose job it is to make sure films and people get into the paper. And I mean, quite often we have to say no because we've got limited space.
How do you find that the rise of online media has affected the reliance of the paper publication of Variety just during the Cannes period?
Well, quite often if a story breaks during the day and we've sent it out as breaking news, then it's already old news by the time people pick up the paper the next day. So we'll need to take the story on in some way, or else put it into a wider context, or just to put it as a brief item. I mean, we do try to encourage people to hold news back so that we can put it in the paper first, but you know, that's tough sometimes, so we just have to do whatever we can.
That was Leo Baraclough there from Variety. This is The Stack on Monocle 24, and a warm welcome from Toronto to our Toronto Bureau Chief, Thomas Lewis. Hello, Thomas.
Hello there, Tom. Thank you very much for having me back.
I know, make it sound like we're doing you a real favour. We don't look at it that way. It's always friendly. Now tell me, it's been a busy time, I'm sure, as always, in the office, and you get lots of interesting people who swing by to come and chat with you. And I know that you had a magazine aficionado and personality who called in this week to discuss Acquired Taste magazine.
Yes, earlier this week, a gentleman came in with the latest edition of Acquired Taste magazine. And what a beautiful little magazine it is. And it's like a little book, you know, you can really imagine sort of keeping it on your shelf for sort of years to come. So it's quite an interesting story because he began this as a blog back in 2007, I believe. And then the interest and the sort of scope of it began to grow. And he felt, well, actually, the only thing that will do this justice is to start printing it, and printing it very nicely indeed. So the focus is on Canadian food producers, but also food producers in the US as well. And there's absolutely beautiful photography in here of farmers markets, of new restaurants opening. There's a spread in the latest issue, which is the 4th issue so far, of Bar Raval, which is quite a celebrated bar that opened last year here, sort of trying to bring sort of Spanish kind of, you know, little eats kind of culture here. But it's got the most fantastic interior you've seen, built by a Toronto-based architecture firm called Partisans, and they've got this swirling wooden sort of shell really inside. It's fantastic, and they've captured that beautifully in this edition of Acquired Taste magazine.
Now, Thomas, let's take the temperature a bit more broadly of some of the other publications, particularly sort of the weekly magazines more engaged in reportage, the magazines that are tasked and indeed deliver, you know, comment on the Canadian condition, life in the country, the issues that preoccupy the people. There's a few, some pretty well-known names. And obviously, they've had lots to get their teeth into recently. We think, of course, of the Fort McMurray fires and the early days of the Trudeau administration, this sort of thing. What do you still look at, you know, when you're browsing the newsstand? A few of the old favourites?
Yes, I have developed a few favourites actually since arriving in Toronto last year, and I think it's quite an interesting and heartening position, I guess, that a lot of these magazines, you know, some of them very well established, some of them are relatively new. So you think of the Walrus, for example, was only begun in 2003, but really has become sort of the news magazine of record for many people here. And I think, let's not forget the neighbour to the south here in Canada, you know, and the media that sort of floods the markets here, but that really hasn't sort of dampened this need, I think, or an appetite, if you like, for well thought out, well reported stories that give a different slant on the big news of the day for a Canadian audience and told in a Canadian way, if such a thing exists. But I think, you know, like you touched on, the coverage of the Fort McMurray fires, you know, the biggest story here in Canada still, the room in which these magazines, so Maclean's magazine or The Walrus, as I mentioned, have been able to sort of, you know, step back and sort of dig a little into just the sort of impact really of basically losing big parts of an entire town. I mean, what that would actually mean, you know, has been a really powerful way, I think, to someone who is still relatively new to this country, to tell a story that is so unfathomable to so many people.
Now, Thomas, you kind of alluded to it briefly in your last answer, and that's talking about the health of the nation when it comes to print products. And I know that there's been some sort of comments this week from one of the big newspaper players, or, well, from the man behind it, one of the biggest players, or the biggest player indeed, about, you know, government aid. How robust, I mean, this is obviously a topic we touch on constantly on The Stack, which is the robustness or otherwise of the print marketplace. When we look at periodicals, you know, do they have the strength to keep on going? Is that a conversation people have about state aid and subsidy? Are people who are, you know, maybe more pragmatic commercially, they say, well, no, look, we need to sort the wheat from the chaff and it can't be about the government getting involved. What do you make of it?
I think it is quite an interesting time, actually. And the comments you're alluding to were made by the head of Post Media, which is the biggest newspaper group here. And he suggested that government subsidies, that the government should step in and offer some kind of either a tax break or financial support to the newspaper industry. Now, that sort of surprised quite a lot of people here, because his sort of newspaper empire, if you like, tends to be slightly more on the conservative side. So the editorials in the National Post, for example, during the election campaign were very, very frequently sort of going down quite hard on Justin Trudeau and the Liberal Party for their campaign to sort of borrow and spend to grow, whereas their conservative counterparts were obviously talking about being more measured and sort of, you know, upholding austerity measures in various fields. So I think a lot of people were kind of surprised by this kind of call, really, or suggestion. Now, I think it is interesting, if you look at the history of sort of the government's role in the newspaper industry, this isn't really something new in Canada. You know, if you look back when newspapers were delivered by the postal service here, well, there was a time when the newspapers were given a discounted rate on those stamps, I believe. So therefore, you know, it was a boon to the postal service because they always had things to deliver, but also it meant that the newspapers could get the news out without, you know, totally breaking the bank, if you like, either. So there is a relationship there. I think it is interesting to look at the Trudeau administration so far, because they are on this quite sort of rampant kind of program of allocating money and identifying areas where the government should be spending and should be sort of, you know, inspiring to grow through government involvement in various ways. So I think this is quite, you know, maybe he's chosen his time quite well, but I think the idea that people still want their news from the old idea of a newspaper newsroom is still something that's quite potent here. But of course, there are challenges to evolve with still here, as there are, you know, in other markets around the world too.
There are indeed, and we'll be reflecting on them as always here on The Stack in the weeks and months to come. Thomas, though, thanks for putting us in the picture with the printed landscape in Toronto. Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis joining us here on The Stack. Now, up next, that's me whistling. It's a whistle-stop tour on The Stack today. Cannes, Toronto, Hong Kong next in our sights. Let's cross over to our bureau and speak to our bureau chief, James Chambers. So, James, I guess kicking off, when we talk about the landscape where you are, it's very much, well, it's kind of divided literally in a sense between, you know, the English language press and the Chinese press. And so we can kind of divide our conversation, I guess, between those two. Let's kick off maybe talking about some big changes. Two of the big players, one in each of those respective marketplaces.
the two, I guess, major players out here when it comes to kind of respectable newspapers are the South China Morning Post, which is an English language newspaper, and Ming Pao, which is a Chinese language newspaper. Both of these are very credible newspapers. They've got long histories in Hong Kong. But more recently, there's been a few changes to the ownership and to the editorial, which have kind of cast doubt on this credibility. And it's got a lot of people worried about the future direction of these newspapers. On the one hand, there's the South China Morning Post, which has just been bought out by Jack Ma, the owner of Alibaba. That's got people worried about how much he will interfere in the editorial content, given obviously he is a mainland Chinese businessman. The most immediate changes have been a change in its business model. It used to be a paid-for paper in terms of online and offline, but now the online version is free, whereas the print version you still get paid for. Jack Ma's takeover is a bit similar to, I guess, Jeff Bezos in the US taking over the Washington Post. You know, he has said he's going to commit a lot of money to invest in the newspaper. They're hiring staff. He's going to use some of Alibaba's tech know-how to improve the paper and make it a bit more savvy. You know, if he sticks to his word and kind of stays out of the editorial side and just brings in his kind of skills and his know-how, then it could be better times for the South China Morning Post, but we'll have to wait and see on that.
Exactly, so that's going to be a bit of a watching brief. What about Ming Pao? You mentioned the Chinese title there, maybe one of the sort of more august institutions, a sort of what? Bit of a kind of FT vibe to it, I guess, really. And again, this has a different billionaire owner, but maybe some similar worries in a sense about the direction that it might go in.
It's true. The person who sold the SCMP to Jack Ma was a Malaysian billionaire, and the Ming Pao is owned by a different Malaysian billionaire. They're kind of overseas Chinese. Whether they're being used as a proxy for by China, I don't know. But they certainly have their sympathies to the mainland. And you might remember that Ming Pao was in the news recently because after they published a front page story about the Panama Papers and its links to certain people over here, the number two editor was sacked that very same day, which led to a lot of the journalists protesting, and there was a big march on May Day. And this all kind of stems to a turning of the tide, really, in 2014, because before then it really was the most respected Chinese language newspaper out here. It has a very long history, and it was started by a well-respected Chinese novelist. But in 2014, the editor called Kevin Lau was sacked, and then a month later he was involved in a knife attack. And it was thought that it was because he was involved in some investigative journalism which exposed links between offshore assets and the Chinese leadership. As that was happening, the new editor they appointed to replace him was somebody who, as again, people suspected as having a sympathetic view on kind of Beijing. Since 2014, when all this happened, there's been a number of things that keep happening, which is kind of get people more and more worried about the future of the paper. And then earlier this year, the well-respected number two editor was suddenly sacked. So a bit like the SCMP, both of these very respected newspapers have a very uncertain future.
Let's talk, James, a little bit briefly about the political divide, because it's not just the language difference. There's also, of course, the clear political divide. So, of course, in some cases, they follow a language divide as well. And it's interesting, you've got some pro-democracy papers in Chinese, and you've got English language pro-Beijing papers as well. China mouthpiece like the China Daily, of course, the European edition and US edition, familiar to many of our listeners as well in those markets. It's an interesting landscape.
It is. I think more and more, Hong Kong is splitting into these two camps. Obviously, you get it in politics. You get the pro-democracy or the pan-democrats, as they're called, in the lawmakers. And then you get the pro-Beijingers or the pro-establishment. You know, there are newspapers and there are mouthpieces for either side. The most vocal newspaper or even media group for the pro-democrats is Apple Daily. This is a newspaper that was started by the media mogul Jimmy Lai, who has an incredible story behind him. You know, he's one of those many Hong Kongers who fled China, came to Hong Kong in a boat, you know, worked his way up in the factories, created a clothing empire, Giordano, which you may have heard of, and then it was actually the Tiananmen Square massacre which kind of prompted him to get into media and get more involved. So he started up a few magazines, and then just before the handover of Hong Kong to the UK, he set up this Apple Daily. He's always very loud when it comes to anything to do with China. He was there during the Occupy protests in 2014. He was arrested for that. You know, he's had kind of knives and axes left on his driveway. He's had his car rammed. He's had his house firebombed. All of this because of his role as this kind of spokesperson for the pro-democrats and the anti-Beijing angle that the Apple Daily takes. It has a circulation in 2009 peaked at 300,000 print copies a day. That's now down at the moment, but he gets, you know, millions of visitors to the website. It's kind of an interesting mix between a very tabloidy kind of paparazzi style coverage, which kind of gets the clickbait on the internet, but also has some kind of credible editorials and commentary on what's going on. So it tries to offer a bit to everybody.
Now, James, another trend that we see in cities around the world, certainly in big cities, is this free newspaper trend. And I gather that's quite a competitive sector too, where you are, once again, we have English and Chinese titles. I don't know, are they competing? Do they live alongside each other quite happily?
Well, they certainly live alongside each other in terms of the kind of real estate they share in Hong Kong. You know, a very familiar sight when you get up in the morning and make your way to work, whether it's getting to the bus stop or getting out of the MTR, you know, the subway here, is that you'll have about three or four street stalls or booths manned by a load of older ladies, older Chinese ladies with their bibs on, aggressively kind of handing out all these free newspapers. And there's about three or four of them. One of them is the English language, The Standard, and then one of the Chinese ones is called AM 730. Now, these they compete side by side, obviously slightly different audiences depending on what you're after and what language you want to read your news in. But you often see a lot of Hong Kongers, especially the elderly Hong Kongers, get up in the morning, leave their houses, go to these stands, pick up every single paper, and then retire back to their homes, I guess, to digest the day's news. One of the ones I wanted to mention is called The Standard. You could say it's a bit like the Evening Standard in London in terms of it's a free newspaper, and it would like to think that it's a quality newspaper. But I guess a lot of people in Hong Kong would probably remember it for the good old days rather than today. You know, when it used to be seen as a credible alternative to the South China Morning Post. It was originally set up by a Chinese tycoon who actually founded Tiger Balm as a way of giving a kind of Chinese voice to certain things in Hong Kong. The South China Morning Post at the time under British rule was very kind of pro-establishment, pro-colonial, and so The Standard was set up to try and give the kind of local Chinese view. But a lot has changed since that time. It's changed its name many times, and during the dot-com kind of boom, it even became known as the Hong Kong iMail. And then since then, it's turned into this kind of tabloid newspaper. It's very thin. It's not a must-read, and it went free in 2007, which is also obviously a bump in the numbers. But it's still going, it's still out there, but I guess it could do with a refresh.
Thank you very much indeed, James. That's James Chambers, Monocle's man in Hong Kong, joining us today on The Stack. And that is just about all we have time for on this week's programme. Many thanks to our producers, Ben Ryland and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and of course to our editor, Claire Urban. Write to us at info@monocle.com, and don't forget to join us at the very same time next Saturday. You can listen again, delve into the archive of this show or any others. We've been talking movies. Maybe the cinema show is where you should head next. You can find all the information you need at monocle.com. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks very much for tuning in.